Welcome to Life 2.0 Podcast, the Saturday morning memo, as it were. Time to go up down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the frickin' senseless, and if at all possible, kids, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. All right, glad to have you back with me one more time on this juggernaut of a podcast. This is year three for this little adventure we called Life 2.0. And let me just clear the decks a little bit before I get to some of the tidbits from the past week that I came across in the news that I thought was worth mentioning, maybe with a little different perspective. Maybe not, but maybe there we can find a little enlightenment there. Sometimes you got to look in between the lines. See what's really going on. When I started this show, it was really about, as I open everyone, finding the obvious and the buried in the absurd and the making sense out of the senseless. Life, as it's presented to us in so many ways and so many levels, doesn't make any freaking sense. So my job's always been in radio is how do I look at the things that we all have some challenge with to a greater or lesser degree, and then come at it from a different perspective. If at all possible. Not always possible, but I make every attempt to do that. And I think that's one of the things, if not the thing, that has kept my career going in so many different ways, that while I may talk about some of the things that everybody else talks about, I make every attempt, as I said, to turn it a little bit. Not spin it, because there's no agenda here. I just want to take another look at it. I want to, if it's under the microscope and I can't tell what it is, I want to pull it out and throw it out and look at it from a telescopic range. And if the opposite is true, if it's too far away, I want to bring it in and take a look at it and go, what am I to learn here, if anything? So it's always been, I think, my calling card in radio, whether I was doing my own show back in Michigan so many years ago, all the stops I've had between then and now, which is like WGN Radio in Chicago. I did Martha Stewart Radio for a week, believe it or not. It's a whole nother show. So when I started the show, I think a lot of people thought I was just going to get on and throw some quotes at you. You know, some motivational quotes. Come on, you can do it. Go out and get it. Make it the world your own. The door doesn't open, knock it down. I do some of that, but I've never found a lot of that works. So over time, in full disclosure, I lost a few, more than a few, subscribers because they didn't like what I was talking about, which is their prerogative. I mean, you don't have to listen. And I was a little confused every time I would get one of these unsubscribe notices, and it would say something like, well, I thought you were going to be more motivational. Like what? Like who? Of course, they never really said who, but I thought I would be more motivational. Maybe more rah-rah. Maybe more, yeah, I don't know. Motivational. Very open-ended term. And I've maintained that I'm not a life coach. I can't. The concept of a life coach is still escapes me, only because I've been in this business and a speaking business for so long that I've seen people get up on stage, open their mouth that, in my opinion, observation, experience, really don't have any business talking. They haven't really done anything, but they talk like they have. Or the latest thing, which is getting some kind of certification that if you go to 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 weeks, you pay some other coach, life coach, to help you become, and I'm using air quotes that you can't see, but you should be able to feel them, that you're somehow certified to tell other people what to do with their lives. And I've never understood that at all. Now, in full disclosure, sometimes I have been very fortunate to go out and speak to corporations, and I've done a couple of TED Talks and things. And while people may feel motivated by listening to what I'm offering, I don't have the intention of being I can't even stand the term. Motivational speaker reminds me of the old Saturday Night Live sketch with Chris Farley, who, you know, is hired to jack up a couple kids who were sloughing off. And he's been in the basement for a couple hours drinking coffee. And he admits that he's living in a van down by the river. And that, to me, while it's very funny, is also very telling because he really doesn't have anything to add to their lives. And he has no qualifications to tell them anything. He's already living in a van down by the river. And I think, I don't know how many people get that when they watch that sketch. It's hilarious. And, you know, I've watched it many, many times and laughed, but mostly because I'm wondering how many people caught on what Chris Farley was saying. I'm living on a steady diet of government cheese, and I'm living in a van down by the river. But let me tell you how to improve your life. And I think there's a lot of that in the world today. So what this show has always been about, and what I try to do every time I get on and fire up this microphone, as I've said, I don't want to just get on and throw a bunch of platitudes out and take up space. And everybody listening to this show is busy enough. They don't need me just to do nothing. And to me, just getting up and going, the rah-rah stuff is empty. And calling out things that are difficult has value to me. So, you know, just to tell someone you can get through this without ever having gone through whatever that thing is, would be bullshit to me. Because how would I know if they could get through it or not, right? So I've really run some lanes that are fairly narrow, quite frankly. You know, I know what it's like to be divorced. I know what it's like to lose a home. I know what it's like to lose a career. I know what it's like to lose my parents. I know what it's like to lose a marriage. I know what it's like to lose a lot of things in life. So if those are experiences you've had, then we can talk. But I don't know what it's like to make $17 million and lose that. So if that's happened to you, we can maybe find some common ground, but probably not. I can't really relate. So my comments, my experiences are what drive this show. And it just kind of occurred to me today as I got a note last week about the show that I did about Deacon Jones, which is two shows ago. I did a Memorial Day show, and then I did a Deacon Jones show. And it really wasn't about Deacon Jones, the football player. It's about what you feel like when you're 12 years old and there's something bigger than you going on, and you get excited about that. And somebody wanted to know, they sent me a note saying, why are you doing a show about a dead football player in the middle of summer? A, not middle of summer, so you're wrong. B, it isn't about him. It was about me. It was how I felt when this helmet that I still have sitting here, obviously, I actually put a new face mask on it, sitting there reminded me of being 12, which does not happen very often at 62 going on 63. That's what the show is about, and finding things in your life that make you feel that way in the midst of all this chaos and turmoil. That's what the show is about. So they unsubscribed because they thought I was talking too much about a dead football player in summer and they needed more motivation. Okay. Your prerogative. So just going forward, know this. You know, I do this show with great intent. First and foremost, it helps me. Like everybody listening, I got a schedule going on here. I'm doing this other show. I tape 7 radio shows in 4 days, then I produce the same amount of shows. So it's another, 14 to 20 hours a week, all inclusive. And it's a lot of mind stuff. I have to sit and listen and time things and all that kind of stuff. It's a very creative process that I've done for a long time, but it's still a bit taxing. So I have regulated Saturday mornings when it's quiet. It's very early here in Chicago. Got a nice hot cup of coffee. And I've regulated this time to kind of unload a little bit. And whenever you listen to this, whether it's today or a month from now or 6 months from now, to me, the intent is always the same. Up the down staircase. What's going on up there? How do we check it out? How do we become more aware of what's going on in our world so it affects us less, quite frankly, all the negative stuff? And then in the outdoor, how do we go around where everybody else is coming out, we go in? Why would you do that? Well, if you're looking for a little motivation, that is like one of the things to do. If everybody is going one way and you want to follow that, that's cool. But you find most of the treasure and most of the gimmies in life by going against the grain. Try it one time. Not easy, not always fun, but it's a hell of a lot more exciting. And then finding sense in the senseless is like of paramount importance to me. I have a bunch of stuff sitting here on my desktop that I use for the radio show, The Bridge. And some of it carries over because I never get to it. And I look at this stuff and I said, this makes no sense to me. How could this be? So how do I find sense in something that's nonsensical? Well, you know, you turn it and twist it and push it inside out and whatever. And one of the things that came up last week that I was unable to use was, only because I just didn't have time to get to it on radio, was this hearing at the Natural Resources Committee where Representative Louis Gohmert seemed to float a novel idea for solving the climate crisis, changing the orbits of the Earth and Moon. Now, before I say another word, this isn't a political thing at all. And if you think it is, then you think it is. But to me, it is not. It is about how do you take someone who is sitting in a position of power and say, this is what they believe, or this is the question they're asking. And it reminds me that you can dress anybody up, make them look good, but that doesn't mean they know what they're doing. And so let me just, in case you missed this, this is exactly how it went down. Gohmert, a Republican from Texas, posed a highly speculative theory in the form of a question to Jennifer Eberlein, Associate Deputy Chief of the National Forest System, at these committee hearings. Quote, I understand that from what's been testified to the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, you very much want to work on the issue of climate change, Gohmert said. Yeah, they've been working on it for a while. I was informed by the immediate past director of NASA that they found out that the moon's orbit is changing slightly, and so is the Earth's orbit around the sun. We know there's been a significant solar flare activities in the recent past, and so, is there anything that the National Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management can do to change the course of the moon's orbit or the Earth's orbit around the sun? Because obviously, that would have a profound effect on our climate. End quote. Taken a bit off guard, Eberlein responded, I would have to follow up with you on that one, Mr. Gohmert. As video clips of the exchange began circulating, Gohmert lashed out at critics who mocked the idea that altering our planet's orbit was a viable or wise solution to climate change. So while it's true that the moon's orbit is changing slightly, that is a function of the ocean tides on Earth. I learned that in fifth grade. Literally fifth grade science with Mr. Antler. The Earth's orbit around the sun is irregular and subjective to wobbling to some greater or less degree, which we don't feel, thanks to a gravitational interactions with Jupiter and Saturn. You can find all that on the NASA website. Gohmert's been a long time climate change denier, but all that aside, I don't know what to do with this one. That's probably why I didn't address it on radio. Meaning that it isn't even about whether you think this climate changes are real or not, but that you think that somehow the Federal Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service could possibly do anything about the orbit, altering our planet's orbit to help climate change. So if this guy deadpanned it and was just being sarcastic, he won. Because I watched a couple of videos and he seems oblivious to the fact. He's like, what are you talking about? I thought it's a viable question. You know, can we somehow change the tides? No, we can't. Next question. I think that would have been the difference if I was sitting in the committee meeting. I would have been like, are you effing kidding me? That's probably why I don't sit in committee meetings. But my point in all this is part of the bigger picture to me is this is not a new thing by any human. Meaning, with some undue respect to the congressman, it's a stupid question. There's no way to turn it that makes it a smart question. Like, well, here's a really good idea. So he's making $189,000 a year to ask these questions. And I find that fascinating, number one. Number two, without the benefit of the internet and without the benefit of the immediate news sources, this might have gotten out like a week later back in the day, or been glossed over, but of course now it's all over the place. And if you missed it, you're probably smart to miss it, but I'll just kind of wrap this up with the concept and the idea that while some of this stuff seems senseless to me, and it is, it's always been this way. We just see it in real time and immediate. And I'm kind of glad I waited 3 days to talk about this, or at least to bring it up, that the concept that so much of what's going on in the world today, especially the shitty stuff, has always been going on. It's so important for me to remember that. It's always been going on. Our access to it has not. And we're coming, all of a sudden, the floodgates are open. What everybody's doing, what everybody says, for the most part, you know, greater or lesser degree on that, is readily available on your telephone. It's not even a telephone. They don't call it a telephone anymore. phone is the correct word. Do you have your phone? Telephone is an ancient term for a device that used to be on a desktop or a wall. Let me stand corrected. So it's on your phone. You can. I used to get updates when I worked at Harpo. I had what was called a BlackBerry, which is different than the BlackBerries I grew up with, I'm here to tell you. Those ones you used to eat. Then there's a machine called a BlackBerry. And this thing was on my hip. And it would buzz every time I had to get an update or some sort of email. And it took me a while to figure out that I was only not only getting my email and updates, but I was getting the whole Harpo Inc. email and updates. My settings weren't correct. I didn't know jack shit about settings back then. And so this thing was going off all the time. Until if I turned it off at night and turned it on in the morning, it would buzz for an hour and a half straight, catching up with everything. And I thought, this ain't going to work. So finally, when I... It was a nifty little machine, but until I figured out how to use it, it was the bane of my existence. And when I turned it in finally, and I gave it back to Harpo when I was gone from there, literally for, 3 weeks, my hip would buzz. There was phantom buzzing on my hip from this little machine. That to me was fascinating because it shows how easy it is for these things to kind of take part in our lives. It was like an attachment. But enough with the horror stories of the BlackBerries. Now they're just better to eat than wear one. I don't even know if BlackBerry still exists. It might be an obsolete thing. Speaking of obsolete, the technology I use to record these shows, this is one of the ones in my lifetime that is like, wow. I actually could tell in months that the technology had advanced. Before it was years. Now it's months. And I got the same cell phone for 6 years. So, and we had the same telephone for about 30. So it's got a long way to go to catch up to that. But the technology I used to tape these shows, I got through a friend of mine named Scott Clifton, who was the chief engineer for Opa Radio. Very smart fellow. We call him the doctor because he can fix anything. And we were having difficulty connecting my studio in Chicago to the studio in Beijing where I do these shows, where we build the bridge together, where we talk about nothing and everything, just to keep the lines of communication open. And all the big, bulky equipment they sent me was not working studio to studio. So ESPN is where he's at now, and they use this kind of online internet platform that is crystal clear. It's amazing, the technology. But before I used this, I had was called a Zoom, not the calls that you might have been on, but Zoom was an actual little box. And I had to hook it up and do, and it was very nifty. It was just literally a palm in my hand it could fit. And I could take it anywhere, put it in a bag, put external mics on, it was great. But before I started using this technology, the Zoom was the thing. And Zoom came out around 2014, 2015, and it was breaking technology. This is the best stuff ever. And I suppose there's still an application for it. If I need to go, obviously, remote, I could take it and use it. But now I sit on my computer, I click two buttons, and here I am. The Zoom, it's still in a little bag in the closet. So within just months of learning a new technology, something has already become obsolete. And I started thinking about how that was never the case when I was a kid growing up for the most part. Things stayed basically the same. As I mentioned, the telephone on the wall was the telephone on the wall. I remember clearly only having about 5 or 6 channels on TV. That was your only choice. And the rumors of cable that was always going to be free, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. The cable was coming at some point. You'd have access to the whole world. And no one could have even thought of something called the internet. My parents could have never imagined having a personal computer, a PC, or a laptop in their home. So those, for so long, things were a certain way. Now this technology... And in my opinion, observation, and definitely experience, as I just mentioned with the BlackBerry, I don't know that getting saturated in all this information all the time is any good for us. Representative Gohmert notwithstanding, so much of this stuff that comes our way, we can't do a thing about it. Nothing. And it bombards us day after day, if not minute after minute. And we look at this stuff and go, this makes no sense to me. That's why I do this show, to at least try to talk through some things that I don't understand, that have attached themselves to me. It's like the BlackBerry taking it off my hip. It buzzes for a while, even though it's long gone. And this thing with like a guy sitting in, you know, a sitting member of Congress asking if the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service can somehow affect the moon and the earth's, you know, rotation. And what? Again, that's probably why I'm not in Congress. This is another one that we took a pass on only because we didn't have time. I don't know if it's always been this way. This might be something that I'm not 100% on. But now when a law is passed, companies seem to get more involved one way or the other. And if a company is in an area where a law is passed, they don't agree with it, sometimes they'll pull out of that area or they'll, you know, that's their way of pushing back on something. And to me, that gets to be a slippery slope, right? Because if you're in business, you're pissing off some of your customers, even though you may not agree with what's going on politically or with the law, you're still taking a little bit of a risk. But unless you're a monolithic company like Coca-Cola, you probably don't worry about that stuff anyway. County commissioners in North Carolina wanted to send a message to Coke by removing its vending machines from county property after the CEO of Coca-Cola spoke out against the changes to Georgia's voting laws. But the machines didn't belong to the Atlanta-based beverage giant. The 12 Coke vending machines on Surry County property were owned and operated by Coca-Cola Consolidated, an independent bottling company headquartered in Charlotte, North Carolina. Commissioners voted Monday to rescind the previous vote after company representatives pointed out the error during a public forum in which several residents also voiced their objections. Allison Patient, Vice President of Government Affairs at Coca-Cola Consolidated, told board members one of its 15 facilities in North Carolina is located in their Surry County. "I'm here tonight," she said, "because the commission has made a decision that directly impacts our businesses and the livelihood of 37 employees and their families that work here in Surry County, and we're respectfully asking that you reconsider your actions." Surry is on the Virginia border, about 93 miles north of Charlotte. Patient also clarified Coca-Cola's Consolidated is completely separate from Coca-Cola in Atlanta and, quote, "absolutely has no control over their opinions or statements about any issue. We just sell their product as a distributor." So here's what started all this. The decision to ban Coke machines in Surry County stems from comments made by James Quincy, the chairman and CEO of Coca-Cola, after the Georgia lawmakers passed legislation last March overhauling voting laws in the state. The legislation contains sweeping changes to voter ID requirements, absentee ballots, it goes on and on and on. And dozens of corporations denounced the law, including the CEO of Coke. And he went on to say, "We want to be crystal clear." I don't know if he really sounds like this, but I feel like reading it this way. Anyway, "we want to be crystal clear and state ambiguously." Oh, unambiguously. "We want to be crystal clear and state unambiguously that we are disappointed in the outcome of Georgia's voting legislation," Quincy said back in April. In response, Surry County Commissioner Eddie Harris made a motion during a May 17th board meeting to remove the Coke machines from county property, calling Quincy's statement an attempt by the major corporations and globalists to circumvent our election process. Harris said the Georgia voting law was an issue of election integrity and suggested Quincy, who is British, go back to England and mind his own business. He probably didn't say that. I put it that way. "I don't believe this will displace any workers in Surry County, 12 drink machines, but I know what? It'll send a little itty-bitty message that we're not going to tolerate this in Surry County, and you take your Coke machines and load it up and take them back to the house," Harris said. The board passed the motion with 3 commissioners in favor and 2 against. 1 commissioner abstained, which is counted as a vote in favor. Harris was later interviewed on Fox and Friends, where he said the vote stemmed from wanting to, quote, "push back against this woke cancel culture. Our citizens support this," he said. "They're absolutely sick and tired of this outrageous left-wing mob that is attacking freedom of speech, that is attacking people's jobs." Yeah, attacking people's jobs. 3 representatives from Coca-Cola Consolidated kicked off an hour-long public forum at the start of the board's meeting in which they urged the commissioner to reconsider. The patient said leadership has never made public statements about election laws in Georgia or any other state. "We feel in this instance we're not really being treated equally," she said. "There's a long list of companies that spoke up about the Georgia legislation. More than 100. The one company that was not on that list was my company, Coca-Cola Consolidated. Yet we're the only ones that appear to have been impacted in Surry County on that issue." Several residents also spoke out against the ban, including Julia Charles Robinson, who described the previous board meeting as, quote, full of conspiracy hate talk and far right-wing activism, end quote. Wes Caudill from Elkins said commissioners passed the vending machine ban against Coca-Cola Consolidated and didn't have a clue about what they did. He said he also heard the commissioners had talked about not wanting companies like Amazon to come to the county. Quite frankly, he said, if you sit on the board of commissioners for Surrey County and you would refuse any company to bring economic development to our county, you're a moron, Caudill said. At the end of the Monday meeting, Commissioner Larry Johnson, who abstained the first time, moved to rescind the board's vote. Harris, who introduced the first vote, and Commissioner Van Tucker, who seconded it, stood by their initial vote in favor of the ban. We're not going to let go of that. I'm holding my ground because I feel like it's the right thing to do, Tucker said Monday. I was trying to send a message to the flagship Coca-Cola, and if there were some casualties beneath that, sorry about it. So, just going back to the guy, this fellow here, Tucker, who said that, I don't believe this will displace any workers in Surrey County. 12 drink machines, who cares? But you know what? It'll send a message to Coke. We're not going to tolerate it in Surrey County. And you can take your Coke machines, load up, go back home. No one did any investigation to figure out who owned the machines, where they were from, nothing. So those 37 families that work there and depend on that as part of their routes and all that kind of stuff, they were affected. I'm going to draw a parallel line here between that and changing the rotation and the orbit and the waves of the Earth and the Moon so climate change can abate or at least be handled. You got to do your diligence, kids. I don't care who you are. It doesn't matter who you are. But what matters is that you have to do your diligence before it explodes out into the world. There's a karmic kickback to everything. If you're going to get on and say, the Moon's made of cheese, I've tasted it, and you can't prove it, you're screwed. If you're going to get on and say, we're going to take these 12 Coke machines out of our building and it's not going to hurt anybody and we're making a statement, and then you find out that it hurts somebody and their families and their economic well-being, that's karmic kickback. And to still stand by it, that you think you're making some big, you know, David and Goliath statement, that's just something I don't understand. There's some great lines in my favorite movie, Jaws, which I'll probably watch 5 or 6 times this summer. Came out way back in 1975, but this is what comes to mind as I'm talking about people opening their mouths before they know what they're talking about. And it reminded me when Quint and the chief and Hooper are all in the boat looking for the shark, and Hooper's trying to get the fishing line secure, but you know, because they've hooked into something, and he says, oh, it's just a marlin or a stingray, but it's definitely a game fish and it's not a shark. And he's trying to pull the line and it snaps, and he goes flying on the deck. And Quint picks up the end of the line. Game fish, eh? Marlin, eh? Stingray. Bit through this piano wire, because that's what they were fishing with. Don't you tell me my business again. Get up on the bridge. And Hooper says, Quint, that doesn't prove a damn thing. And Quint says, well, it proves one thing, Mr. Hooper. It proves that you wealthy college boys don't have the education enough to admit when you're wrong. You know, admitting when you're wrong, if you want to get into motivational stuff, that might be one of the toppers. Admitting that you're wrong, that you screwed up. You know, I didn't understand what I was talking about when I meant we could change the tides so that we could work on climate change with the Moon and the Earth. Come on. Come on. Wrong. Admit you're wrong. And then these folks down with the Coke machines, even when all the evidence is presented that they were banning these machines and it directly affected people's livelihood and Coke could give a shit, right? Admit that you were wrong. They still stood by their votes to make that stand. So listen, in the last couple minutes we have here together, I still had a bunch of other stories to get to, but the point in all of this is that motivation, inspiration are often the most difficult things to do in the world. There's no certification for it. It is found in the difficult points and parts of life. It's found in a congressional hearing where somebody comes up with something so ludicrous and senseless that it makes your head spin. And in my opinion, go, how did this person get elected? How is this person even part of the process that makes decisions for other people? And then go to a county level where the same thing is being done, that the due diligence wasn't put forth to find out first, even though they admitted it's not going to hurt anybody, and it did, and you still don't care enough to admit you're wrong. Sometimes we just need to watch Jaws, I suppose. And finally, there's this tidbit, in case you missed it. Something on a much lighter note. An Italian artist auctioned off an invisible sculpture for $18,300. It's made literally of nothing. The sculpture, Salvatore Garu said, it is a work that asks you to activate the power of the imagination. So, last month, the 67-year-old artist sold an immaterial sculpture, which is to say that it really doesn't exist, for $18,300. To be fair, the artist might disagree on conceptual grounds. He says, a vacuum is nothing more than a space full of energy. And even if we empty it and there's nothing left, according to the uncertainty principle, that nothing has weight. Therefore, it is energy that is condensed and transformed into particles that is unto us. I don't even know what the hell he's talking about. Don't want to know. But I will tell you this. Last summer, I went to the Art Institute here in Chicago. And there was a frame on the wall in one of the rooms, a picture frame, which is supposed to be there because it's the frickin' Art Institute. And there's a picture frame hanging there. And there was nothing inside the frame except the wall that it was hanging on. And I looked at it. I thought, oh, somebody stole something valuable. No, apparently I wasn't the first person to ask the guard if this was, you know, like somebody stole the artwork. He said, no, that's the piece of art. And so in all of this, everything I'm talking to, I guess the bottom line is it's all how we see things. Apparently, you know, the people in the little county thought that they saw a chance to stick it to the Coca-Cola company by taking 12 Coke machines out. Turned out that it hurt a few people that in their livelihood, at least it was restored. So that's a good thing. And maybe this congressperson, I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt here, obviously didn't know any better and threw it out there. But I think it's also indicative of what happens when you don't know what... so much what goes on in the world are people who seem to know everything about everything but haven't done anything, but they talk like they do. And if you happen to see a picture frame on the wall with nothing in it, it could be worth a lot of cash. Have a great day. Safe travels. Until next time. Adios.